court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated.
Well, good morning. Looks to me like maybe we have some high school students here. Mount Horeb High School, my notes tell me if that's correct. Will you please stand? Oh, very good, very good. You may be seated. We are very pleased to have you join us this morning. We'd like to have the students come in. The students are here on a program called Court with Class that we run in combination with the State Bar of Wisconsin. So they know a little bit about the case that you're going to argue to us this morning. Now, students, if you can stay after this argument, Justice Rebecca Dallet, who sits down there at the end of the bench, will come down and chat with you a little bit, not about the merits or the substance of this case, but about how cases get to the Supreme Court, what they might have been through prior to coming to see us. So if you can stay, please do. And anybody else who would like to stay is certainly welcome to come and have a conversation with Justice Dallet. So with that little bit of housekeeping out of the way, I will call our second case of the day, Portage County versus J.W.K. Counsel, are you prepared to begin?
Yes, sir.
Please do.
And certainly, I do have a soft voice, so if I'm not loud enough, please let me know.
Fine. You're doing pretty good. If the microphone is just in the right place, it generally works, but if we can't hear you, we'll be waving at you.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
May it please the court. My name is Katie York, and I represent JWK, who I will be referring to as John, as we did in the briefing. There are two questions presented by this case today. First is whether John's appeal of his extension order based on sufficiency grounds is moot because the circuit court entered a new extension order prior to the completion of the appeal, and actually prior to briefing in this case. The second issue is, if the sufficiency claim is not moot, then did the county present sufficient evidence here to extend John's commitment? More specifically, did the county present clear and convincing evidence that John will be a proper subject for commitment if treatment were withdrawn? The United States Supreme Court and this court have repeatedly stated that a civil commitment involves a significant deprivation of liberty that requires due process protection. Because of the massive curtailment of liberty, commitments cannot continue indefinitely without the government regularly proving by clear and convincing evidence that the individual is still mentally ill and still dangerous. If at any point the person is no longer mentally ill or is no longer dangerous, the commitment must end. To satisfy these due process requirements, in Wisconsin we have Chapter 51, which lays out the procedures and standards for a civil commitment. In Section 5120, for an original commitment, the county must prove that the individual is mentally ill, that mental illness is treatable, and the person exhibits some sort of recent dangerous behavior. There are five different ways that the statute lays out that an individual can prove, or the county can prove, the recent dangerous behavior. That order can last no longer than 6 months. If the county wants to extend the order, they have to file a petition with the court. The court has to have a hearing and issue a decision within that six-month period. If they do not do so within that six-month period, the court loses competency to rule on the extension hearing later. For an extension hearing, the county must prove again the person is mentally ill and dangerous. The dangerousness standard changes at that point. There is no requirement to prove that the individual is exhibiting recent dangerous behavior, although recent behavior is certainly relevant and should be presented. But at that point, the county need only prove that the individual will be a proper subject for commitment if treatment were withdrawn, and that's based on the record. An extension order can last for only 1 year. If the county wants to extend that order after a year, they have to again file a petition for extension. That has to be heard and decided within the year. And again, if it's not heard and decided within a year, the court loses competency to act on that petition. So the question here is whether or not the sufficiency claim is moot. So we have to look at whether or not there is a practical legal effect upon a then-existing controversy.
Counsel, though, don't we have a doctrine that basically provides that even if regard to this particular person are deciding the issue you raise won't cause a change, but it is the kind of issue that is apt to recur. So we consider it, I don't know if we call it an exception to mootness or whatever, but we do generally address an issue that's likely to recur. And isn't this that kind of an issue?
I think, yes, that's true. Even if something is deemed moot, the court can still render a decision on that issue. But I think this goes beyond that doctrine, because what we're asking for is for this order to be vacated because the evidence is not sufficient. But also, that means that all of the subsequent orders no longer are valid because they were based on invalid, insufficient order. Because when you have these extension hearings, you have the original commitment, then you have extension hearing, and each extension order builds upon the previous order. You can't have a standalone extension order because of that change in the dangerousness.
Okay, so it's sort of like a game of dominoes. If you can push one over, all the ones that follow will fall as well. That's pretty
Absolutely.
Much your argument, right?
Excellent analogy, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
So, counsel, is that true with respect to every potential challenge to a recommitment order, to an extension order? That is to say, there are more grounds than just dangerousness that need to be proved to commit someone, right?
Yes.
Okay. So including such things as establishing that they are that there is a mental issue involved, that they are a proper person for treatment, right?
Yes.
And those are separate and apart from dangerousness.
Yes, different elements, yes.
Yep. So is it possible that an extension order could be challenged on the basis of, let's just say, no longer being a proper person for treatment?
Yes. Yes.
And under that circumstance, if you succeed on that, does that necessarily invalidate all subsequent extensions? Because it's not the deficiency is not a question of the original dangerousness. It's just at that time, was the person adjudicated to be a proper person for treatment?
Yes, because I think the Constitution requires that the county repeatedly prove that the individual is both mentally ill and dangerous. So I think that goes to the mental illness piece.
Right. So let's focus on that. So let's say we have original commitment, extension one, and extension two.
Okay.
Under a review of extension one, we say, you know what, the doctor did not bring his A game. He brought his B game. We don't really think he brought the proof that this person is still mentally ill. And so, you know, the extension order one is deficient. However, since that time, extension order two has come along, and he's under commitment pursuant to extension order two. Why would our conclusion with respect to extension order one invalidate extension order two?
Because you have a gap. So you have a period in time where the individual was improperly held on commitment when they weren't actually mentally ill. So because the orders build on each other, and I see what you're saying, mental illness isn't as clear-cut as the dangerousness standard because the standard will always be the same regarding mental illness. So that's a different situation than what we have here. But I still believe because there's a gap in the orders that you would have to start over from an original commitment. So if the county at that point wanted to commit the individual, they would have to file a petition and allege recent dangerous behavior.
In paragraph, in page 5 of your brief, you said if John had been able to obtain a favorable Court of Appeals decision on his sufficiency claim before the circuit court held another extension hearing, there's no question John's commitment order would be vacated. Is that necessarily true? Could the Court of Appeals have sent it back for a new hearing?
On a sufficiency claim? No, I don't believe so. because they have the one-year period where they have to have the hearing and they have to issue an order within that period. And if the court sent it back for new testimony, we'd be outside that one-year timeline to issue that decision. Unless if for some reason everything went so fast and the order was well within the one-year timeline, but I don't think that would ever happen. And as Justice Kelly just pointed out, I think everyone would agree that the order should be vacated if the county did not prove that the individual was both mentally ill and dangerous at that extension hearing, and the order or the decision was issued prior to any extension orders, any new extension orders. So the question here is whether or not John is entitled to the same relief simply because he wasn't able to get his appeal completed fast enough before the next extension order occurred. And I think due process requires that he is entitled to the same relief, because the county has to continually prove that the individual is both mentally ill and dangerous. If it occurs this time, what's to say that if the next appeal isn't fast enough, the next one, we have 2, 3, 4 years where the individual doesn't have meaningful appellate review of whether or not the person is still mentally ill and dangerous, because the appellate process does take quite a bit of time. And certainly there are a number of reasons why an appeal might not be completed within that 1 year. It could come from the public defender's office. As this court is well aware, we have a shortage of attorneys, so we are often required to ask for extensions before we can even appoint an attorney. The clerk can ask for extensions. The court reporters can. Certainly counsel can ask for extensions, and that is all outside of the client's control, but yet it could impact, if this court determines that this issue is moot, it could impact whether or not they actually obtain the relief that they're entitled to.
So you're focused on the second part, not the mootness, but on the sufficiency of the evidence. Is that there wasn't sufficient evidence of dangerousness? Is that where you want us to look?
Yes.
Okay. And why don't you think the doctor's testimony was just another way of stating that standard for dangerousness?
Because the doctor's testimony was very cursory in this case. The county asked the question, is there a substantial likelihood based on the record that John would be a proper subject for commitment if treatment were withdrawn? His response was, it is my belief, yes. And then there wasn't any follow-up at that point on direct about why. And I think that's really the concern here. There's no explanation as to why he would be a proper subject for commitment if treatment were withdrawn. What behaviors would he exhibit?
Okay, but you just explained to us a little bit ago that every hearing rests on what was determined before. So wasn't it part of the foundation that was looked at the hearing? What were his circumstances before that raised the dangerousness concern and provided sufficient proof?
Well, the doctor testified that he reviewed John's records.
Right.
Beyond that, we don't know specifically what he relied on, what he reviewed, and what made him come to the decision that he came to. So,
but if there's proof in the records that he reviewed, and that's what he said he did, and then he made the conclusion based on his review of the records, why aren't the facts from the record part of the foundation for the conclusion?
Well, we don't know that there's proof in the records. I don't know what records he's referring to because
he
didn't...
medical records, probably. He's a physician, right?
But none of that's in the court record. The judge doesn't have the opportunity to weigh that information and agree or disagree with what the doctor's determination was. We don't know what those records are. Certainly, he could have explained what's in the records. He could have explained... You know, he keeps on saying that he's not going to take his medication, and therefore, because of that, we think that he's going to revert back to the way he was before he was committed. Certainly, that explanation is relevant. What's in his medical records could be relevant, But we don't know what's in those records, and I'm assuming, because the doctor didn't testify about anything specific to John that would make him a proper subject for commitment, that there isn't anything.
So, counsel, you're not challenging the original commitment order, is that correct?
Correct. That, okay. I didn't have that case.
So let's say the doctor came to court on the hearing for the extension order, and he says nothing more than nothing's changed. Would that be sufficient?
No.
Why not? We already have an extension order that determined that that all of the elements necessary for commitment have been satisfied. Dangerous, mm-hmm. mentally ill, proper subject for treatment, all of that, right? So if the doctor comes in and says nothing has changed, doesn't that mean that all of those things still apply?
Well, first of all, if he said nothing's changed, then I question whether or not he's treatable if his condition hasn't changed or improved at all since being on the commitment.
Well, nothing changed in terms of, you know, my conclusion. Let's say he's the same testifying doctor.
Okay.
Yeah? So in the original commitment, he says, I find that he's mentally ill. I find that he is a proper subject for treatment, meaning that he can be rehabilitated, right, mm-hmm. and that he's dangerous. And so now same doctor comes back with extension hearing. He says, nothing changed, which is to say that he finds that he's mentally ill, proper subject for treatment, and dangerous. Why isn't that sufficient?
Because for the court to truly assess whether or not he's still mentally ill and still dangerous, there needs to be some sort of explanation, some sort of factual explanation as to why he meets that standard. And the standard is different, right? From the, we're talking about original commitment,
yeah.
and then first extension.
For dangerousness, the standard changes.
Right. Mm-hmm. So for the original commitment, the county had to prove recent dangerous behavior. So if it's just the first extension hearing, I don't know how it could be the same, because he wouldn't be exhibiting this exact same dangerous behavior necessarily.
Right. So on the dangerousness prong for recommitment, the standard is what? That he would be a proper subject for commitment if treatment was withdrawn?
Yes.
Okay.
So I would want to know why the doctor thinks that he would be a proper subject for commitment. So, for example, if the doctor testified that he's saying that he's not going to take his medications as soon as he's done with the commitment, he's not going to participate in any sort of treatment, and the doctor says he will revert back to the way he was prior to the commitment, then that could arguably be a reason that he was still dangerous. But we don't have that here.
So what is the rule that you would like to see? Is it that all the medical records have to come to the court for an in-camera inspection and then have a doctor do a complete presentation on his condition? What's necessary?
No, I'm not saying that. But the doctor, when giving his opinion, can talk about what is in the records and what he relied upon. I want some facts related to the person specifically as to why he is still, or she, is still dangerous. So
how much does he have to tell the court so that the court can make that determination? I mean, the courts are in a difficult situation in these kinds of hearings, right? They're not doctors. They're not experts on this sort of thing. They really do rely a great deal on the testifying doctors. So what's the minimal amount the doctor has to be able to tell the court for the court to come to a conclusion that you would accept?
There has to be some sort of factual link between the standard and that individual. So if the doctor is able to just come in and repeat the standard and say, I agree with the standard, he's a proper subject for commitment if treatment were withdrawn, and that's all there ever is, then really there isn't much of a point to have judicial review.
Counsel, didn't that more than that happen here, though? I get what you're saying on the original questioning on direct examination, but on cross-examination, the doctor was asked about basis for concluding his insight and judgment are impaired. He talked about intimidating behavior. Then the social worker testified about specific threats that were made. So, I mean, as far I understand the concept that you're talking about, but as far as the facts of this particular case, there's more there than just the one conclusory statement.
I don't believe that this transcript for this hearing involved specific threats.
Isn't this transcript from July 21st of 2017?
No, it's August 1st, 2016.
Okay. So that was the previous transcript from the previous
I think that might be the subsequent. Is it 2017?
It's July 2017. So you're saying yes. That's the subsequent?
Yes.
So you're saying August?
August 1st, 2016.
Okay.
Was the date of this hearing. And I can tell you, you are correct that on cross-examination, defense counsel did ask why he met the dangerousness standard, and the response was, on the history of the overall struggles with chronic mental illness for many years with variable levels of compliance with treatment and leading up to a point of variety of altercations or need for mental health commitment, and that's on page 10.
Okay, and isn't that enough? Those are specific facts that relate to this case.
Well, first of all, chronic mental illness, that's going to be virtually everyone that's on a commitment, so that's not particularly helpful. Variable levels of compliance with treatment. I don't know what that means, and I don't know what treatment he's referring to. Is he referring to, you know, you have group treatment where you're doing certain sort of artwork or you're talking to other peers, or are we talking about substantive treatment with your doctor? I'm not sure what that means. Leading up to a variety of altercations. I don't know what kind of altercations he's referring to, and I don't know when he's referring to. Is this years ago? Is this recent? I don't know. And a need for mental health commitment, I mean, that's going to be every single person that's subject to an extension order. So it doesn't give me or the court any insight into what it is specifically would happen with John if treatment were withdrawn. And I understand the doctor can't predict the future, but they certainly can speculate based on what's going on, what they think would happen. And just to be clear, John testified that he would take his medication and he would participate in outpatient treatment if he was no longer on the commitment. The record does indicate that he's a veteran, so he does have VA benefits. I believe he might be on SSDI. So there are resources for him outside of the commitment that he could take advantage of.
I want to return, leaving the sufficiency of evidence question, and go back to the first issue. It's your position that the appeal from the 2016 commitment is not moot. Is that correct?
Yes.
And it's not moot because, now these are my words, not yours, because of the cascading effect or the need for a chain that doesn't have a break in the chain.
Correct, yes.
What are the practical consequences of let's say you prevail on a person prevails on a 2016 appeal, then the case is to be dismissed? Is that your position?
Yes.
And it's necessary then for the county to start anew and meet the requirements of an original or initial commitment. That's your position.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And what are the consequences of the differences between the burdens in the initial and the recommitment standard, vis-a-vis, for instance, overt acts?
So for an initial commitment, there would need to be some sort of recent dangerous behavior. It could be omission. It could be an overt act. There's five different ways that the county can meet that burden.
And in essence, is it the recent overt acts that is the gravamen of the differences between the two?
Yes, I think that's a big piece of it. Certainly, it's more difficult to prove that there is some sort of recent dangerous behavior as opposed to building on the previous extension orders or the original order to show that the person would be a proper subject of commitment.
And if a person had been institutionalized and had been receiving medication, and as a result of that, not likely to demonstrate recent overt acts of dangerousness, what subsection do you then rely on in your new commitment proceeding?
I don't know if I understand the question. What if they filed the new petition?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. What section for dangerousness?
Yes.
It's 5121A, 2, A through E are the five different
yes.
kinds of dangerousness.
And which of the ones, A through E, would, given that a person had been institutionalized and had been successfully medicated, let's say, so they demonstrate no overt acts of recent dangerousness, then if we start anew, what of the subsections A through E would you be relying on if you were the county?
Well, it would have to depend on his behavior. It would have to depend if he has any behavior that would justify the commitment order. So certainly if the order is vacated, it's not automatic that they would be able to file a new initial petition. It would depend on whether or not he actually is dangerous at that point. Does that make sense?
How does 5120 1 A E, like elephant,
yes.
fit into our concerns? Or should it fit?
Is that the fifth standard?
That's really what my questions
okay.
were headed.
Okay.
That's what I kind of figured.
So, right. yes. So that would be a situation where essentially the individual is unable to care for themselves. So there's not necessarily outward dangerous behavior like threats or something like that. That's more a situation where the individual isn't, you know, feeding themselves, isn't taking, you know, proper housing, doesn't have proper housing, isn't able to care for their kind of daily living.
Well, it also includes an individual who is either incapable of expressing an understanding of the advantages and disadvantages of accepting medication or treatment and the alternatives, or a substantial incapability of applying that understanding.
Yes.
And why doesn't that fit your client?
Why doesn't that fit John?
Why doesn't it fit John? I think that was one of the things that the court determined, that he's schizophrenic, correct?
Yes.
And the concern is that if he doesn't take medication, he will become increasingly paranoid and be increasingly unable to control his thought patterns. So it's kind of hard to figure out, should I take the medication or not? Because if you're not taking it, then it's kind of difficult. If you need it to think and you're not taking it, I think that's kind of what Sabi is looking at.
Certainly. My red light.
Yeah. Do you want to answer briefly then?
Sure. Absolutely. I don't think that the evidence at this hearing proves that he would not take his medication and he wouldn't participate in treatment. That may be true if he stopped taking his medication and wasn't participating in treatment, that he maybe would revert back and fit into subsection E.
Okay.
But I don't know that the evidence presented at this hearing proves that.
Was sufficient. Okay, good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. May it please the court. Can you guys hear me okay?
You can move it up just
a little bit. A little higher?
Oh, okay. That's better. Much better.
All right, perfect.
Thank you.
I'm attorney Brianna Sweeney. I represent Portage County. We are here today to determine whether or not a case that has since been recommitted, or excuse me, has since come before the court again in 2016, should be found moot when a new recommitment finding has been found since that time. Previously, the appellate court did find that this issue was moot, that since John had been recommitted since that time, the 2016 case was no longer applicable. It is a new order that he has since been put under, and therefore there's no existing controversy. Mootness does exist when a determination that is being sought cannot have any practical legal effect on an existing controversy. And there is case law that says there's an apparent lack of live controversy when an appeals order, when an appellant appeals an order to which he is no longer subjected. Currently, John is appealing the order from August of 2016.
He has been recommitted since that time. In July of 2017, another order was entered. There was another hearing presented. New evidence was given. New testimony was given. That order was entered into on a completely separate set of facts.
Counsel, if the 2016 order is moot, how were you ever supposed to review a commitment order?
That's a good question. I think that it would need to be in a more timely fashion if there was a commitment order to be reviewed. I understand that it does take a long time to get through the various appellate courts, and I do understand the time constraints that we are under with various people taking place or various people as part of the process, but I do believe that that 2017 hearing is its own set of facts and own hearing. It is based on the original commitment order, but it is not necessarily based on the recommitment order other than they're in a line. They go in a row. I think if you overturn that 2016 order and vacate everything afterwards, you do risk putting the public as well as this individual in harm's way should new facts and incidents come up that would require a commitment or a recommitment.
You know, counsel, do you agree with your opposing counsel's domino argument that if, in fact, we would determine the proof was not sufficient, that all of the subsequent orders are also insufficient?
I do not agree with that.
Why not?
I do believe that under the law currently that, yes, the recommitments do follow. I mean, they are reviews every year, but I tend to believe that the recommitment would be connected more towards the original commitment order and where the original recent overt acts occurred. And then the recommitment is more of a follow-up to what the original commitment alleged and using new current recent acts to further or whatever the current circumstances may be.
So taking that to its logical conclusion, if there's been five extensions, you think it only relates back to the original commitment but not to any of those extensions?
In the statute, it does state the entire treatment record, so I do believe all of that is relevant. I don't necessarily think, though, that because something wasn't sufficiently proven in one, that if it was sufficiently proven later, that one shouldn't exist anymore.
If you're,
that previous one was.
If you're correct, talk to me about timing then. I thought that you had to do a recommitment or an extension within a certain period of time.
Correct.
You can't have a commitment from 2 years ago and then say, you know what, we now want to do a recommitment or an extension, right?
Correct.
So how do you work through the language of the statute with the argument you're now making?
Well, I do believe that there is a recommitment hearing every year, and there was in this case a recommitment in 2016. And the sufficiency argument is difficult to make when there is further facts that are sufficient. And if the underlying court did find that there were sufficient facts in the 2016 hearing, it does seem to go forward. I think it still requires that the court have them within timelines. I do agree, though, I can see challenges as to appealing those underlying cases for sure.
What would the valid order be that would be in place at the time the subsequent order was issued?
The previous order, because it hadn't yet been appealed.
Well, that doesn't make it valid, right?
Correct.
I mean, it is for the time being, but if it's overturned or not correct, then...
Correct.
Can you think of any better arguments on that?
I think that the reality of each commitment hearing, each recommitment hearing, is that there's due process is given at that time to the individual. So when John is brought before the court in 2017, he is again given the opportunity to confront his witnesses and testify on his own behalf, and all of the dangerousness and things that are required to be there are there. The fact that I'm of the opinion that the 2016 one was valid, so it's a little bit more of a difficult shift to make for me, but I do think that given that that's a whole other set of facts, that sufficiency is still there. It was previously reviewed, and therefore it would still somewhat continue. I mean, the facts are still there that he was under that recommitment.
Okay, so talk about why you think it's valid.
Okay. A lot of the justices did touch on it just a bit. As was said by counsel, 5121 or 5120 sub 1 sub AM does state, for a recommitment, a person has to be a proper subject for commitment if treatment were withdrawn. They're not required to be dangerous at that time because they're receiving treatment, because they're receiving medication, because that is being watched. It's unlikely, in fact, that they will not, that they will be overtly dangerous at the time. There has, in the transcript, the doctor did say specifically, if treatment were withdrawn, he would be a proper subject for commitment. Based on that testimony, the judge did find that that was sufficient. The doctor had been working with him previously. He did testify to that effect. And I don't know that there is anything specifically that says just saying that specific part of the statute isn't enough. The judge is there to make conclusions based on how credible the witnesses are and whether the doctor was credible or not. And unless the doctor is... Unless their findings of the court are clearly erroneous, which I haven't seen any clear error here, they should not be overturned at this time. But secondly, as was touched on in the cross-examination, the doctor did state that previously John had not been compliant with his treatment. There had been a number of altercations. There have been times when he wasn't complying currently. That's why the judge was, or the doctor was of the opinion that should treatment be withdrawn, he would need commitment again. John has a long history of mental commitments. I believe he's been under a mental commitment since 2013. And I think that he has difficulty, because of his schizophrenia, knowing he needs to continue to take that medication.
He's always been committed under Chapter 51, though, right?
Correct.
So I had trouble using AM. I know it was in your brief, because it applies to voluntary admissions. That's not John. Revised to protective placement. That's not John. Applies to outpatient treatment. That's not John. And then, or a Chapter 975 requirements have been met. Well, that's not John. So is it the last one, or recent behavior under paragraph A2D may be satisfied by showing there is a substantial likelihood based on the subject's treatment record that the individual would be a proper subject for commitment? Where are you relying on it? I had a problem with AM. I thought E worked a little better for you. But.
Okay. He's still technically a subject of inpatient treatment. So that would be him. He is currently at the time of this hearing, he was at Trumbull Medical Center, which is not a hospitalization, but it is inpatient, the higher level of treatment facility.
But an individual has been the subject of inpatient treatment for mental illness, developmental disability, or drug dependence immediately prior to the commencement of the proceedings as a result of voluntary admission. That's
or
not John.
A commitment. The next part is a commitment.
Voluntary admission, commitment. I see. And you're relying on the fact that he was committed and he's still under that order.
Correct.
Okay, good.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
I want to continue to focus on that language, however. And as read, I focus on immediately prior to commencement of the proceedings. In total, it is this. If the individual has been the subject of inpatient treatment for a mental illness, developmental disability, or drug disability immediately prior to commencement of the proceedings. What is meant by that, immediately prior to the commencement of the proceedings?
I would suggest it is immediately prior to the commencement of the recommitment petition, because it's a new application and petition for recommitment. So if he is currently, before we file anything with the court, he is currently inpatient because of a mental illness and he is committed,
doesn't that then, in part, the language support your opposing counsel's premise that this is a continuing thing? That is, you start with the original, and then the uninterrupted chain is a recommitment and a recommitment. That language seems to support that premise rather than what I hear you arguing earlier, that is, that it really you focus on the original commitment. And so that language caused me some concern vis-a-vis your argument.
I can see that for sure. There is some question with regard to that timeline because, again, you are supposed to consider the entire treatment record and all of that as well, which is why I do agree, at least in part, that there's a question. I do think a recommitment hearing does provide new evidence, however. It is not all specifically based on the last hearing. And I do think that each recommitment hearing is its own process and opportunity for John to challenge what he is currently being presented with. Again, that being said, I do think, given the entirety of the treatment record, given what the doctor testified to, while it may not have been overt dangerousness, it doesn't need to be overt dangerousness. The counsel did mention in her brief about him being polite. Being polite isn't necessarily going to, that doesn't mean that if you take away his commitment, his treatment, he's not going to become dangerous. He has had a long line of, as the doctor said, altercations while under the commitment. So I don't think it's a far leap for the judge to make that if the treatment were withdrawn, that a commitment would be required when he's under a commitment and he's not fully availing himself to the treatment required. And he's continuing some dangerous behaviors. I do think that in this case there was sufficient evidence to uphold the 2016 commitment. There is a case, I believe both parties cited, JWJ versus Waukesha County, in that the doctor stated that the patient had a history of improved behaviors when appropriately medicated and deterioration in the ability to function in the community when not appropriately medicated. That sounds very similar to me to what Dr. Persing says in our case in front of us. I think that, in addition, Dr. Persing stated that John was not actively participating in treatment at that time. I don't see anything that is clearly erroneous by the judge taking the doctor's opinion up and stating, that was sufficient, clear, and convincing evidence that John is in need of a recommitment because of the fact that when he's under a commitment, he doesn't completely avail himself to the services and treatment available to him and continues to have a concerning behavior. There wasn't overt dangerousness at the time, but there was following up after the fact. I think that at this point we would ask that if you do not deem this a moot issue, we would ask that you uphold the 2016 case. I do understand that due process is so important for individual rights. However, the state also has the burden to protect the public and protect this individual when they are dangerous towards themselves. And I think, as shown by the next recommitment, he continues to be dangerous. And I think that that was based in the treatment record and everything that was going on with the doctor during that time. And while he may not have testified as clearly and as detailed as counsel would prefer, I don't think that doesn't mean that the inference by the judge couldn't have been made reasonably that he wouldn't be in need of recommitment at that time.
Counsel, if we were to conclude that the doctor's testimony was too brief, what's the proper remedy for that? Do we vacate the commitment order? Do we send it back and say, you know what, here's the framework that you have to meet in order to support an extension order? Go try it again. What do we do with this?
I think, based upon the fact that there have been further hearings since that original hearing, remanding it back and allowing the trial court to get more information from the doctor would make sense. I do understand what counsel argues with regard to the timelines, but again, if we're looking outside the timelines for purposes of the appeal, it seems to me we could look outside of timelines for the purpose of remedy of appeal. I think that if you remand it back and allow the doctor to further expand on what issues there were, we would have gotten there.
Counsel, can you talk for a minute about the Zaraki case and how you would distinguish that case, which seems to support your opposing counsel's position in addition to the language of the statute and interpretation that is the domino effect interpretation?
Sure. So I distinguish Zaraki specifically in my brief. The court in that case did rule that recommitments are a continuation of the original commitment hearing. And recommitments in context of the substitution of a judge.
Okay, but why is that different?
Because the substitution of a judge is a procedural matter. It's not necessarily the substantive matter. If you allow someone to procedurally, every single step of the way, change a judge, you are allowing them to judge shop, essentially. And it could end up with different judges in a different community making different decisions every year.
We do that all the time in Milwaukee County. So when you get a new judge assigned, you have a right to substitute, and it kicks in as soon as the new judge is assigned. So just the mere fact you might have a new judge, tell me how the reasoning is somehow different just because it's a substitution issue.
Well, to me it was because in that case, every single time they did bring that up, they specifically said the substitution of a judge at the end of it. And it felt intentional to me because it seems to me if it was supposed to be a continuation for all things, it wouldn't have needed that the extra context in there for that. And while I understand a lot of times procedurally we do substitute over and over again, in this case, because it is a continuation, there's a similar set of facts, and it could be different. You could end up with different judges and different decisions every step of the way on relatively similar facts, which would then result in, you know, kind of, it's not conducive to a Chapter 51 continue.
So you think the decision was based more on kind of the public policy implications as opposed to really a clean reading of the statute?
Correct. That's how I would read. Because Zaraki does also go on to state that at every recommitment that the circuit court must make a new determination of the individual suitability for commitment at the recommitment hearing. Evidence of individuals' recent behavior is presented. Evidence presented at each recommitment hearing may be different from the evidence presented at the original or continued recommitment hearings. And it was in this case. It's very different each case we've had since that than it was in the original. So that's how I would distinguish that case. Any further questions?
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. So I just had a few points that I wanted to make with regard to the record. The county mentioned a long line of altercations being mentioned in the record at the hearing. I don't believe that's what it says. It said leading up to a point of a variety of altercations. Again, like I mentioned last time, I'm not sure exactly what that means, what those altercations were, or how they relate to his current dangerousness. Also, with regard to treatment, I know that the doctor, when talking about John being removed from Trempolo, he referenced not participating in treatment. Again, he talked about therapeutic treatment and recreational activities. I'm not sure exactly what that means. I don't know if it's the kind of treatment that he absolutely needs to have to keep himself from being
Counsel,
dangerous.
I have a question that's kind of bugging me, and maybe it's nobody talked about it, but maybe they didn't because it's not relevant.
Okay.
We have a lot of case law that says when you're in a criminal proceeding and there is an error at the preliminary hearing stage, but the matter goes on and there's a fair trial, either by a judge or jury, that later fair trial cures any error that may have been in the preliminary. Why isn't that like what we're doing here, where even if I would agree with you that the 2016 hearing was light, there's been a full exposition of his dangerousness in 2017, so why isn't that a cure for the rights he would try to vindicate if we were to overturn the 2017? In other words, doesn't that get under your domino theory?
Well, because that extension order builds on an invalid order, first of all.
Well, you can say the trial built on an invalid preliminary. That's the argument that's always made. preliminary had errors. Everybody agrees it was errors. But we don't give them a new trial. We say, hey, the trial was fair, evenly balanced by the judge of the jury. He had all the rights of trial. And that's it. The old mistake was a mistake, and we move on.
Well, for a criminal case, there's no requirement that the facts at the trial, there's no different standard because of the previous order. The previous order allows for the lower dangerousness standard because there is that continuous order. And that's not occurring in a criminal case. The other piece, I think there's a competency issue related to timelines.
Okay.
So you have to prove within 1 year that the individual is still mentally ill and dangerous. If there's not sufficient evidence, you haven't proven it within a year. So you're thwarting the whole purpose of that timeline and the standard because there is no purpose of just having a hearing within a year. The purpose of having the hearing is to prove that the person is still mentally ill and dangerous within a year. And for mental health commitments, there is a competency issue implicated because the standards are implicating these strong due process rights. And so if you look at GOT, which is a case I think from the late 80s, if you don't have that extension hearing within a year, you lose competency. I think the same applies in this circumstance.
Okay, thank
but
you.
We have the competency hearing within a year. The appeals are taking some time.
Yes.
Right? And generally speaking, when we get done with the appellate process, if there's a remand, then we engage in the legal fiction that we're remanding to the point in time at which the error occurred, right?
Yes.
Why can't we do that here? So we say, if we were to agree with you, the doctor's testimony was deficient because he just didn't bring any evidence to the table, why can't we say, all right, here's the standard. Doctors, just so you know, when you testify in these kinds of hearings, this is what we need to see.
Mm-hmm.
All right, go back and do it again. Why can't we do that? Just rewind it back to that point.
Well, I think the first piece is the due process piece. You can't have a period of time where an individual is committed when they're not mentally ill and dangerous. The county had the opportunity to present sufficient evidence that the individual was mentally ill and dangerous, and it didn't happen.
Right,
that's
but if we were to agree with you on that,
okay.
It would be on the basis that the doctor didn't bring the evidence to the table. That's not to say the evidence doesn't exist, right? It may or may not.
I'm not going to say that it does exist because I didn't.
Well, right. I mean, but it could be that it exists and he didn't bring it,
okay.
Or it could be that he didn't bring it because it doesn't exist, right? But those are equally those are both valid possibilities. Yeah.
You know, that analogy makes me think of Standard D versus Ghetto, which I didn't cite in my brief, and I can give you the cite right now. It's 175 with second 490, and that's a Court of Appeals case from 1993. It involved a protective placement order where the county was unable to have the hearing within the 30-day timeline, so the court dismissed without prejudice. The county immediately refiled the same petition. Same thing happened the second time around. 30 days, couldn't have the hearing within the time period, dismissed without prejudice, refiled. Third time, they did actually prove that the individual did need to be protectively placed. The problem is that you didn't abide by that 30-day timeline, and it completely defeats the purpose of having that statute if you can just dismiss and refile, dismiss and refile, dismiss and refile. And I think that's what's happening here. If you don't prove the person is mentally ill and dangerous within that year, 2-3 years down the road, you're completely defeating the purpose of the one-year timeline if they can just come back and get a second kick at it.
But then isn't that suggesting that this actually is moot? If an appeal can't get us back to the point of error, then this truly is moot, isn't it?
No, because the subsequent orders have built on this invalid order.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for an interesting case and for fine briefs. We don't get a lot of commitments, so your briefs were very helpful and the arguments were very good. We're now going to recess until 1:30 when we'll have our third case for the day. Students, if you can stay, please do. Justice Dallet will be down shortly, and we are now adjourned.